Good morning. This is session 214 of the Sunstone Symposium, so hopefully you're in the right place and so am I. My name is Becky Johns and I have the privilege of being able to chair this session, and I'm very excited about the topic and our speaker today. So I'm briefly going to introduce him, and then he says he's going to take about 35 minutes or so, and there'll be some time left over for questions and answers. So be thinking of some things that you would like to ask him. Remember that that you need to silence all cell phones. Since this is early in the day, we need to remind you about that. And anything else that might make a lot of noise. And then we'll just ask the speaker to speak loud enough. I don't know if this is what you're speaking into or that, but you will just, the AV people will come by. And so, but if you're asking a question later on, just be sure you stand up and you're nice and loud. We are privileged today to hear from Christopher Smith, who is, as you can see from the program, is pursuing a PhD at Claremont Graduate University. We assume in Mormon studies, but maybe not.
North American religions.
Northern American religions, very good. His recent publications include Sacred Sci-Fi, Orson Scott Card as Mormon Mythmaker in Sunstone, and The Inspired Fictionalization of the 1835 United Firm Revelations in the Claremont Journal of Mormon Studies. We're excited to hear about the contested meaning of democracy in early Mormonism and Methodism. I turn the time now over to Christopher Smith.
Thank you. Pleasantly surprised by the turnout because my Facebook friends were giving me a hard time for using the phrase bourgeois liberals in my abstract. So I'm glad that you all came despite that. I'm going to start out by just defining a couple terms. Do you guys all know what I mean when I say populism? Populism is kind of like triumphalism of the common man. It's poor people asserting themselves against rich people. It's mass movements. With a lot of energy and a lot of mobilization from the grassroots. That's kind of what I mean when I talk about populism. And then two other terms that I'm going to be using a lot are Jeffersonian and Federalist. And these are terms that refer to the political climate in early America. There was, shortly after the Revolution, two parties emerged. One was the Anti-Federalist Party, which was the party of Jefferson. The other was the Federalist Party, which was the party of John Adams. And basically, the Anti-Federalists were the small government party, and the Federalists were the large government party, strong government party. Jeffersonians tend to define freedom in terms of personal autonomy, so it's freedom from authority, whereas Federalists tend to define freedom more in terms of freedom from injustice. So if you're a Jeffersonian, the key to maintaining freedom is keeping government small and decentralized because you want to be free from authority. Whereas if you're a Federalist, the key is keeping government benevolent, so having checks and balances and things like that, properly constituted government in order to make sure the government promotes justice. So key Jeffersonian ideas are things like small government, local control, private property, freedom of conscience, separation of church and state. Whereas if you're a Federalist, you want kind of more an activist government that's going to actively promote values like equality, prosperity, security, moral education, perhaps even religion. So that's basically the fundamental political context of early Mormonism and Methodism. They're entering at a time when these ideas are in the air. And so... if you get nothing else from this paper, hopefully you'll at least come away knowing who the Federalists are and who the Jeffersonians are. Okay. In his book, The Democratization of American Christianity, renowned Americanist historian Nathan Hatch documents a sort of popular religious revolt that took place in the early 19th century. It was a revolt against religious creeds, hierarchies, and denominations. The effect of this revolt, according to Hatch, was to democratize American Christianity by making religious authority and participation available to a much broader spectrum of Americans across many race and class divides. Hatch also ties this revolt to a Jeffersonian political ideology that stressed decentralized government, the separation of church and state, and the right to individual judgment in matters of religion. So to summarize, Hatch describes this early 19th century religious revolt as populist, democratic, and Jeffersonian. And among the groups that participated in the revolt, he lists the Mormons, the Methodists, and the anti-denominational Christian movement, which is also known as the Stone Campbell movement. You may know them as Campbellites, Disciples of Christ. So there's a lot to admire about this thesis. Certainly, Hatch is right that there was this outpouring of populist sentiment in both religion and politics in early 19th century. Popular American preachers railed against aristocrats, priests, denominations, and unconverted ministers. Both religious and political participation increased among the lower classes throughout the first half of the century, particularly as a result of the mass revivals known as the Second Great Awakening. And Hatch is also right that this was a very Jeffersonian age. In fact, the Jeffersonians so dominated the country's politics at the beginning of the 19th century that the opposition Federalist Party actually completely disbanded in 1816. And until 1828, you only had one major political party in the country, which was a Jeffersonian party. So, not surprisingly, Jeffersonian politics did inform the rhetoric of many religious dissenters, especially in the anti-denominational Christian movement. But having said all that, I kind of want to decouple these categories that Hatch is talking about, populism, democracy, and Jeffersonianism. And I want to suggest that democratization is not really the best term to describe what happened in the early 19th century. Hatch uses the term democratization to talk about an increase in mass participation in religion. But mass participation in and of itself is not enough to constitute democracy. In fact, if you look historically at popular movements throughout the centuries, usually they're not really that democratic. Usually the best mobilizers are charismatic leaders with very strong personalities, domineering personalities, popular tyrants. Often they facilitate their work by eliminating institutional restraints on their own power so that they can do a better job of mobilizing people and directing the movements that they start. So, for example, fascism was a populist movement. The Bolshevik Revolution was a populist movement. Jacobinism in Revolutionary France was a populist movement. All of these had very high levels of mass participation. They were all very, movements of the common man, but none of them were really particularly democratic. So, as I'll show in a few minutes, many of the people who opposed the popular religious revolt that Hatch is talking about actually saw this sort of mass participation as a threat to democracy. They worried about religious enthusiasm and that was going to result in all kinds of moral depredations and ecclesiastical tyranny and other threats to democracy. So it's not that those critics of the revolt were anti-democratic, but rather that they had a different conception of what democracy meant and how democracy is supposed to be maintained. Personally, I think that by presenting the populace as these champions of democracy and equating popularization with democratization, Hatch has kind of taken sides in this debate. He has bought into the populist political rhetoric. So I want to kind of decouple those ideas. And another thing I want to critique is Hatch's portrayal of this populist revolt as a sort of uniformly Jeffersonian movement, because I don't think it was. Certainly many were Jeffersonians, especially when we're talking about the period from 1800 to 1828, when the Jeffersonians had this practical monopoly on American politics. But again, there's nothing inherently Jeffersonian about populist religion, and in fact, populism tends to have a very kind of un-Jeffersonian social dynamic. Okay, so to illustrate this critique, I want to zero in on the Mormons and the Methodists. And particularly the phenomenon of dissent from the Mormons and Methodists. Hatch himself admits that American Methodism and Mormonism were structured in highly undemocratic ways, which he calls a curious paradox. But it's not really all that paradoxical when you if you don't equate populism with democracy, as he's doing. If you understand that populism and Jeffersonian democracy don't always go together. So I'm going to illustrate this phenomenon by showing that dissenters from the Mormons and the Methodists tended to be kind of the quintessential Jeffersonian Democrats. These are people who denounced their movements because they weren't Jeffersonian enough. They denounced Asbury, Francis Asbury, the leader of Methodism, and Joseph Smith, the leader of Mormonism, as ecclesiastical tyrants and religious despots. Now, by no means were these dissenters more populist than the groups that they were denouncing. Whereas the populists tended to be down on their luck lay people just looking for a kind of more participatory kind of religion, the Jeffersonian dissenters from these populist sects tended to be highly respectable, capable men with this abiding concern for proper institutional structure. They were lawyers, politicians, and ecclesiastical leaders. They were men who had the education to deal with the nuts and bolts of ecclesiastical governance, but who often possessed little personal popular appeal. By and large, it seems that in these movements, populism and democracy were working somewhat at cross purposes. They were moving in opposite directions. So I'll start with the Methodists. The only Methodist minister who stayed in America during the American Revolution was Francis Asbury, because John Wesley basically told all of the Methodist ministers to come home to Britain during the Revolution. But Asbury decided to stay. And 10 years later, Wesley appoints Asbury as the superintendent of Methodism in America. But Asbury responds by basically rejecting Wesley's authority by having himself elected to the position by the other Methodist ministers, which at first sounds like a very democratic move, right? But it's a rejection of Wesley's authority over the movement. And one of the interesting things is that the first thing Asbury does is changes his title from superintendent to bishop, which from both Wesley's perspective and from a Jeffersonian perspective, bishop is not a title that you use. There was this fear of bishops. Bishops were the epitome for Jeffersonians of ecclesiastical pomp and tyranny, because bishops were a symbol of the Anglican Church, the Anglican Church that had tried to assert itself as the state church of the colonies. And so the Jeffersonians, being committed to separation of church and state as they were really opposed to the idea of a bishop. So it's interesting that even as Asbury makes this kind of democratic move with his left hand, he's making this claim to almost autocratic authority with his right hand. The election that he held was really more a rejection of Wesley's authority than it was a kind of affirmation of a democratic principle. And Asbury was the kind of guy who could totally get away with this because of his mass appeal. This is a guy who personally traveled 300,000 miles on horseback during his lifetime going on the preaching circuit, who preached 17,000 sermons, ordained 4,000 preachers, including African Americans. By all accounts, he was an extremely humble person. He was a tremendously charismatic preacher and a very effective organizer. So in other words, he's like a master of mass mobilization. But at the same time, he's somebody who's keeping a very tight control on the movement. And not only did he claim the title bishop, but he's also acting like a bishop, right? He is personally assigning all of the ministers to their ministerial districts. And if you don't like where you're assigned, tough luck. You know, you're stuck there. And you can either stay and do what he tells you to do, or you can go. He also does things like unilaterally institutes a constitution for the church. It's not voted on. He just does it. He sets up an elite general council for the church, to govern the church, whose members are handpicked by him. So, you know, not surprisingly, this is really distasteful behavior to the Jeffersonians in the denomination. And this, by the way, is all happening at the height of the contest between the anti-federalists and the federalists in the political sphere. And we don't really know where Asbury fell politically, because he was kind of an apolitical figure. But what he's doing institutionally with the denomination looks very federalist. To Jeffersonian eyes, this is monarchialism at work. And so one scholar has written that Asbury, quote, unwittingly acted in a way that, to his opponents, marked him as a northern monarchical federalist. His general council reflected the federalist penchant for small oligarchic government. The council also meant centralized government rather than local rule for the Methodists. Added to that, Asbury's propensity to dress like a British bishop was too much aristocratic display for the republican ethos that was growing in America. So it's for this reason that in 1792, a prominent Methodist minister and writer named James O'Kelly and about 1,000 of his followers denounced Asbury as a tyrant and led an exodus from the Methodist Church. O'Kelly and about 1,000 followers formed a group known as the Republican Methodists, which was basically founded on the Jeffersonian principle of autonomous local rule, autonomous congregations, and the absolute right to private judgment in matters of religion. But what's interesting is that O'Kelly's movement kind of flounders. It doesn't have the mass appeal that Asbury's Methodism does. And I would argue, really, that it was precisely Asbury's strict control over the movement that made him such a force to be reckoned with in terms of mass mobilization, that made it possible for him to grow the movement from 500 members when he started to like 217,000 by the time he died. I mean, that's a tremendous explosion under his authority. And so note that I'm not saying Asbury was an undemocratic tyrant like Kelly was saying he is. He's not a monarchialist. But he does have a very federalist concept of democracy. So where the Jeffersonians are defining liberty as a sort of total freedom from all authority, the Federalists are talking about liberty through properly constituted authority. For Federalists, freedom isn't so much about absence of authority as benevolence of authority. And by all accounts, Asbury was a very benevolent authority. So is Hatch correct in painting Asbury as a populist and a Democrat? Yes, absolutely. But I think it's misleading to talk about Asbury as part of a Jeffersonian democratization movement, as Hatch is doing. So that's the Methodists. Now let's talk about the Mormons, which is what you're all here to talk about anyway, right? Joseph Smith is a lot like Asbury in that he's an extremely charismatic figure with tremendous popular appeal, especially with the poor. He's doing things like evading creditors, instituting a socialist economy, telling everyone that they can receive revelations, that kind of thing. So he's very much a populist, very much empowering the common man. But was he a Jeffersonian Democrat? In my opinion, not so much. You can see why Hatch would think that, right? Because he's using this typically Jeffersonian rhetoric. He's denouncing priestcraft. He's denouncing secret combinations and tyranny and so forth. But when you look at the institution that he created, what do you find but priests and secret rituals and a strong central authority and even this kind of strange fusion of civil and ecclesiastical government? So when Smith is denouncing priestcraft and such, he doesn't mean those things in a Jeffersonian sense. He's not talking about rejecting priests as an idea. He's not rejecting the idea of centralized authority. He's rejecting the misuse of that authority. He's rejecting priestly malpractice. He's rejecting unjust government. It's a very federalist kind of conception of justice and what power is supposed to be, what authority is supposed to be. But it's interesting that his followers, these Jeffersonians in his movement, when they turn on him and reject the denomination, they are interpreting this rhetoric in a very Jeffersonian sense, and they're using exactly the same rhetoric against him that he was using against the establishment. But they're interpreting it in a different sense. They're interpreting it in a Jeffersonian way. So, like James O'Kelly, the dissenters from Mormonism tended to be respectable, high-ranked leaders in the church of a Jeffersonian turn of mind. The witnesses to the Book of Mormon are a prime example of this. So 6 of the 11 Book of Mormon witnesses apostatized. And the other 5 either died before the controversy, or 3 of them were members of the Smith family. So pretty much everybody who was not a Smith who lived long enough apostatized from the church. And all 6 of those who apostatized had served in major leadership roles in the church. So take, for example, Oliver Cowdery. For the first 5 years of Mormon history, Cowdery is basically Smith's right-hand man. Among other things, he serves as the assistant president of the church, second highest office. He's also quite successful in the secular arena. He served as vice president of a bank, justice of the peace, and later was quite successful as an attorney, even running at one point for state legislature. So a very respectable person. And the reasons for Cowdery's disaffection from Smith are various and many, but a major factor appears to have been his Jeffersonian sensibilities about private property and the separation of church and state. After the failure of the Kirtland Bank, the Mormon bank that Joseph Smith set up, Cowdery defies the United Firm, which I don't know if you guys know what that is. It's kind of the socialist, semi-socialist organization that Joseph Smith set up, where you were supposed to consecrate your property to the firm and then it would be distributed to the poor. Cowdery rejects this idea. He sells his lands in Jackson County rather than consecrating them to the church as he had been commanded to do. Shortly thereafter, he's excommunicated. And one of the reasons given for his excommunication was that he virtually denied the faith by declaring that he would not be governed by any ecclesiastical authority in his temporal affairs. In a letter explaining his actions, Cowdery appealed to the right to private property, and he accused Joseph Smith of, quote, trying to set up a kind of petty government controlled and dictated by ecclesiastical influence. This attempt to control me in my temporal interests, he continued, I conceive to be a disposition to take from me a portion of my constitutional privileges and inherent right. Cowdery's brother Warren agreed, writing in a church periodical that, quote, whenever a people have unlimited confidence in a civil or ecclesiastical ruler or rulers and begin to think that they can do no wrong, they increase their tyranny and oppression and establish a principle that man, poor, frail lump of mortality like themselves, is infallible. Who does not see a principle of popery and religious tyranny involved in such an order of things? Clearly, in this conflict, the Cowderys were the more Jeffersonian party, but it was Smith who was the more populist party. The whole point of the Kirtland Bank had been to print currency to pay the saints' creditors, and the whole point of the United Firm had been to provide for the basic needs of the poor. Cowdery's concern was for individual rights, whereas Smith's concern was for the eradication of injustice for the poor. The Cowderys weren't the only ones who left the church after the bank failure. This was the occasion of Mormonism's first major schism. According to Marvin Hill, in the upheaval at Kirtland, the degree of control to be possessed by the church and its leaders, the degree of consolidation in the kingdom was at stake. Hill says these dissenters wanted a more open society, closer to the values and traditions of evangelical Protestantism, while those who supported Smith tolerated a more closed society based on higher law. The prime example of this phenomenon is Cowdery's fellow Book of Mormon witness, David Whitmer. Whitmer, of course, was another highly respectable church leader. He served as president of the Missouri branch of the church. In the secular sphere, he was a very successful businessman, and later served a term as mayor of Richmond. He's no slouch. Whitmer had converted to the religion of the Book of Mormon, which, according to his reading, was basically Protestant and Jeffersonian in flavor. So when the Book of Mormon religion starts to be eclipsed by this ecclesiastical kingdom that Joseph Smith is setting up, Whitmer becomes deeply agitated about this. And among other things, he objected to Smith's monopoly on revelation and the introduction of the priesthood into the church's organizational structure. He also shared Cowdery's concerns about private property and the separation of church and state. In 1838, Whitmer met with a half dozen other prominent church leaders to discuss Smith's attempt to unite ecclesiastical and civil authority and force men to use their earthly substance contrary to their own interest and privilege. Meetings like this resulted in an open schism that climaxed in Whitmer's excommunication. At least one more of the 1838 dissenters also deserves consideration, John Quarrel. Like Cowdery and Whitmer, Quarrel was decidedly respectable. Within a year of his conversion, he was appointed head of a branch of the church's Missouri settlement. In secular life, he was an architect, a carriage builder, and a surveyor, and apparently had some literary education. In 1838, he was elected to the Missouri legislature. Quarrel didn't identify himself with the other 1838 dissenters, who in his opinion were motivated by pride and love of wealth. He was much less concerned than Cowdery and Whitmer about the right to private property. His rejection of the United Firm was rooted more in his distrust of church leaders to use the funds properly than in any kind of principled objection. In fact, he voluntarily sold off his property and personally distributed the proceeds, a small fortune of $2,100, to about 160 poor Mormon families. But Quarrel's overall rhetoric was at least as Jeffersonian as Whitmer's and Cowdery's. His real break with the church occurred in 1838 when certain church leaders began to talk openly and seriously of murdering the Kirtland dissenters, thereby riling up a mob spirit and prohibiting free speech. Quarrel concluded that Smith and Rigdon, quote, intended to set up a monarchical government in which the presidency should tyrannize and rule over all things. For my own part, he wrote, I had rather enjoy liberty in hell than suffer bondage in heaven. Kenneth Wynne has concluded that the seeds of Quarrel's dissent were already present prior to his conversion in his Jeffersonian worldview. Quote, Quarrel would never surrender his private judgment to the authority of prophetic rule. A second major Mormon schism occurred in 1843 and 1844. If the Kirtland Bank was the catalyst for the first schism, this time it was polygamy. But again here we see that the dissenters' disaffection also had some deeper ideological roots. As in 1838, the most vocal Nauvoo dissenters tended to be respectable leaders in the church with a Jeffersonian frame of mind. Isaac Scott listed some of their names. William Law, one of the first presidency, Wilson Law, Brigadier General, and Austin Coles, President of the High Council. Isaac Scott himself was a Mormon preacher from New England who, along with his wife Sarah, apparently possessed some education and writes these lovely, elegant letters. The Scots opposed Mormonism for a lot of reasons, but one of the big ones was that church leaders were constantly trying to silence the opposition, whether through intimidation or slander or the destruction of printing presses in Nauvoo. And after Joseph and Hiram Smith are killed, Isaac Scott writes, I believe they would have been living men today had they been willing for others to enjoy the same liberties they wished themselves. A very Jeffersonian indictment. The most important of the Nauvoo dissenters was William Law. Law was a counselor in the first presidency. He was heavily involved in the administration of business and real estate in Nauvoo, and he was also personally quite wealthy. Although Law was extremely loyal to both the church and personally to Smith, the seeds of disaffection began to sprout in 1843 and early 1844. The revelation on polygamy and the use of revelation to reinforce Joseph Smith's monopoly on the Nauvoo real estate trade, and also Hiram Smith's political ambitions, all these things are like grating on Law. And then the straw that breaks the camel's back is when Smith makes the moves on his wife. Like other dissenters, Law depicts himself when he writes in the Nauvoo Expositor as a democratic crusader, pitting reason, justice, and virtue against the prophet's tyranny and oppression. According to Lyndon Cook, Law's concerns, quote, essentially related to a growing concentration of authority in the hands of the president of the church and the extension of that authority into the areas of politics and economics. In other words, Law had a typically Jeffersonian sensibility about the need for decentralized church government and separation of church and state. By no means was he a populist, He had no charismatic appeal to the masses or no deep concern for the poor. Instead, he's a respectable and educated man with a deep Jeffersonian suspicion of institutional power. And this really is the crux of my message, that populism and Jeffersonian democracy are not the same things. They do go together in some contexts, notably the Stone Campbell Christian movement, which is kind of the quintessential example of Hatch's thesis, a populist movement with this very Jeffersonian cast. But I'd say more often than not, populism employs some fairly un-Jeffersonian federalist kinds of methods. And in many ways, those methods are the key to populism's success. And on the flip side, the most thoroughgoing Jeffersonian thinkers often were, and still today are, very respectable, affluent community members with enough kind of legal knowledge to be able to recognize when institutional power is getting out of control and starting to compromise people's individual rights. As it turns out, this situation is exactly what we find in early American Methodism and Mormonism. Smith and Asbury were rowdy populists with a kind of federalist frame of mind, whereas their critics tended to be these respectable Jeffersonian bourgeois people. And in these movements, populism and Jeffersonianism are really contrary currents running in opposite directions. Both currents understood themselves to be democratic, but each understood democracy differently. So what all this suggests in my mind is that Hatch's description of the early 19th century and his, as a period of religious democratization is really kind of too vague to be useful, and I think popularization would be a better term. Popularization is a term that accurately describes the fundamental shift of the period, which is the increase in mass religious participation, without implying that all of these popular movements were cut from the same Jeffersonian cloth. So, thank you.
Do we have any questions? Yes, go ahead.
Asbury was apparently taking a lot of authority unto himself in the reorganization of Methodism in this country. Mm-hmm. Did he stay connected or loyal to John Wesley in England in so doing, or did Wesley kind of distance himself from Asbury?
They stayed connected, but there was continual sort of tension there. And really, Asbury was the leader of American Methodism.
I should have asked the question that way. It's a good answer to, a good brief answer to a long question.
Yeah.
There was tension between them.
Yeah. There, I would say that Asbury recognized Wesley as the theological authority of Methodism, but that he resisted recognizing Wesley as the institutional authority.
Second question about Oliver Cowdery. He returned to Richmond, Missouri in 1848 and was rebaptized. Was that because of a change, or was that because he had tuberculosis and was dying?
I think it's partly because Joseph Smith was out of the way, honestly. The Mormons were continually trying to reconcile with him and trying to get him to come back, but he felt this sort of deep injustice because he felt that he had been excommunicated unfairly, and he blamed that on Joseph Smith. He felt that Joseph Smith had essentially pushed him out of the church. So once Joseph Smith was dead and gone, I think Oliver Cowdery felt like he could come back.
Though I'm still not convinced that Cowdery, I mean, made that complete. I mean, why in the world did he go back to David Whitmer? David Whitmer,
he was married to his sister.
Well, but there was more than that. To me, there was way more than that.
And Whitmer certainly felt that Cowdery had never returned to the church.
Right.
In his later interviews, he says Oliver Cowdery died an apostate. So there is kind of a, you know, question as to how sincere that return was or how complete it was.
I wanted to just say, first of all, great paper.
Thanks.
This really is not touching upon, but I think it may give at least some support is that I was talking with Dan Vogel the other day, and he had suggested that Zion's camp really changed everything when it came to charisma within the church. That once Zion's camp happened, that charisma stopped with Smith to a point, and authority started taking over. There was a transition. And that might play into your stuff there. And then I made the suggestion that the charisma part might have moved in to Joseph Smith Sr. with the patriarchal blessings. So still keeping that, but Joseph introducing his authoritarian structure or authority structure.
I see an authoritarian streak there from the beginning. If you read the Book of Mormon, continually there's this sort of union of ecclesiastical and church authority. I see Mosiah as kind of a template for what Joseph Smith planned to do with building the New Jerusalem in Indian Territory. So Mosiah goes to Zarahemla, he teaches them their history, he teaches them his language, and he's basically made their king and rules the city. And Joseph Smith, his plan from the very beginning is to go to Indian Territory and build the New Jerusalem as a city of refuge in Indian Territory. And so I see really, I mean, his ambitions, at least from the outset, are to be an authority. And the Hiram Page incident illustrates this, that he's sort of cracking down on other people exercising that kind of authority. He wants to empower other people, but it's an empowerment that he wants to be, he wants to maintain control, really, institutionally. And Zion's camp, if it was anything, may have been a pivotal moment and other people sort of embracing that claim that he was making, but I think the claim was present prior to that.
I guess I'm not being very clear, and I have a problem with that at times. Dan wasn't saying that Joseph wasn't the leader, okay. But what he's saying is that the charisma took a second seat to, and even, and more of that has to do with the structure. You know, it's not until after Zion's camp that you got the 12 that being called, the 70 being called, the bishops, you know. I mean, you've got Partridge early on, but you start seeing much more of an organization forming after Zion's camp. And which also, the other thought to that is that by doing that, because if you remove charisma, or at least not have as much, what's the attraction? Mm-hmm. If you empower people, such as setting up the 12, the 70, and all of that, you now have people attracted because you're making them part owners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did Asbury handle the dissension? You know, you have the excommunication from Joseph Smith. How did he do that?
He initially tried compromise. He basically dissolved the general council that he had established with his handpicked members, and he instituted a kind of more democratic general council as a way of reaching out to James O'Kelly. He writes this very nice letter to James O'Kelly and says, you know, can we get past this? And James O'Kelly was very encouraging. So Asbury thought it was over and done with. But O'Kelly wasn't satisfied, ultimately. He still felt like Asbury's claiming to be bishop. Asbury isn't letting me pick. O'Kelly felt like he should have the right to sort of private judgment about where he's preaching and who he's preaching to, and Asbury wasn't allowing that. So ultimately, O'Kelly just wasn't satisfied. Yeah.
So, you offer a political narrative in terms of explaining apostasy, and the LDS Church offers a spiritual narrative, right? But the key terms for the LDS Church would be disobedience, unrighteousness, unworthiness. Are there ways that in your research where those narratives intersect and overlap, where the political becomes spiritualized, or the spiritual narrative or disobedient narrative then becomes politicized?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, John Quarrel felt that David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery, when they're talking about the right to private property, and, it, you know, this is ecclesiastical tyranny, the whole United Firm is ecclesiastical tyranny, Quarrel felt like they were motivated by greed, essentially. They were not willing to fork up the cash to care for the poor. And I don't want to suggest that the political is all there is, you know. There certainly were personal animosities. There were spiritual and moral kinds of concerns. With William Law, you have the deep offense of Joseph Smith coming and trying to get with his wife. So, I mean, there's lots of other factors at work, but I kind of wanted to highlight the political aspect just to problematize the Hatch thesis a little bit. So. Yeah?
You used a term, and this may be from, from Hatch, of unconverted ministers. What was meant? Was that just an attack on just other church leaders? Or?
Yeah. There's, so in Anglicanism and some of the other sort of mainline denominations, historic denominations of the colonial period, they would actually pay their ministers, and ministers would be theologically educated. The way you became a minister was to basically go to seminary. And then in the Great Awakening, you have what's called the New Lights, who are claiming that to be a minister, you have to have a conversion experience. You have to have some kind of spiritual experience where you feel that God has revealed to you that you've been converted, and your sins have been forgiven, you've been born again. And for the New Lights, that is the requirement to be a minister. If you don't have that, then you shouldn't be preaching. And so that's really where that whole rhetoric against unconverted ministers comes from. Also railing against ministers who take money, who get paid, because that was seen as two sides of the same phenomenon. And Mormonism reflects that rhetoric.
Do you think that there was any, as part of the later schisms in the LDS Church, that especially with Whitmer and Cowdery and some of the others, that especially during the Kirtland period when Joseph was trying to centralize into the society, that some of them were feeling that Joseph was trying to aggrandize their money into his uses and his control, and you know, from that period on, Joseph, of course, never held a job, never, you know, he was living off of the church and did the rest of his life. You know, the church provides him with a mansion house in Nauvoo and so forth. But do you think that was an actual cause of some of these people leaving the church? Was, again, that would be sort of an anti-democratic type of feeling that Joseph was setting himself up as the leader that all the revenue should flow to and all obedience should be given to and so forth?
Oh, yeah, that certainly was a concern. I mean, that's what Quarrel was worried about with giving his money to the United Firm, is this isn't going to go to the poor. This is going to go into the pockets of the church leaders. Financial malpractice really was a big concern for these guys.
During that period of time, do we have any evidence that anybody else other than Smith's family was being supported by the church? It seems to me that, you know, Thomas B. Marsh and others were all still, even Oliver Cowdery and the Whitmers and so forth, they were all basically providing for themselves. I guess the first bishop of the church was provided for out of the tithing funds. But other than that and Joseph, you don't see other leaders of the church like we have today. Of course, all of the 12 and probably most of the 70, at least the first quorum, are provided for out of tithing funds and so forth. But at that point in time, it seemed to be just, strictly speaking, Joseph and the presiding bishop that were provided for.
Yeah, I don't absolutely know the answer to that question, but that's kind of my impression, too.
Well, Brigham Young.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, Becky had a question.
Oh, go ahead.
Brigham Young, after, it's pretty interesting that Brigham Young, after the Kirtland Safety Society started, he talks about that he didn't even have money to have shoes. He was so poor. And then after the Kirtland Safety Society, he went out and bought himself a new suit. He bought himself a house, and he bought himself a ranch, a farm. Mm-hmm. So he was flush with money.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
What year was this?
Well, the end of 37, 38 was the Safety Society, so it would have been sometime in there.
Sorry, you think that money came out of the Safety Society in some way?
The certain people did quite well. The poor, such as Brigham Young, would do quite well. The people, and even Lyman Johnson.
How did that work since the Safety Society went bankrupt, basically?
Well, that whole thing is so weird because it's a completely different monetary system in the United States. The entire United States had a completely different monetary system. It was, each state had their own monetary system, and then that was even broke down into regions. And so it wasn't uncommon for the bank to print its own script, but there was the enormous depression that happened at the time, along with not having a license to be a legitimate bank. And then there was just really not much funds. The funds that were put in by, like, the Johnsons and the Whitneys and people like that, they lost substantial amount. The Johnsons lost everything. And so that was how there was at least enough there so that then somebody like Brigham Young could come along and have script that at least was worth something for a short time, maybe a week or two.
So you're saying that the script that he received from the society enabled him to make
to do that, right? It was at least recognized for a very short time. Again,
so
we're
the people that accepted it from him
right.
were the ones that took the loss.
I was just going to ask about Quarrel, I think you said, gave the $2,100 to 160 families. Was there anyone else that did that? Was that a sort of a movement to directly give to the poor instead of going through the church?
You know, I don't know.
That would be an interesting thing to look at, wouldn't it?
It would be.
And how did he identify the 160 poorest families? You wonder if that was just completely his own determination or if there was something.
Yeah, probably.
He was a counselor in the state presidency, Becky. So
he would have some information, you would
Bishop
think.
Was he, I think maybe, and I may have that wrong, he may have been Bishop, but he was a counselor.
So he might have known.
Partridge, yeah, with Partridge he could have.
Could have had some information
because
there.
Of his position.
Yeah.
I just wondered at that time how they could have gotten that information on so many people, and then if Quarrel did it, did others, like-minded people, follow that example? Because to me that is such an obvious expression of, I believe this, and not only do I believe it, but I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. And despite what the church leader tells me to do, I'm going to directly provide this money to the poor to make sure that it gets where I know it's going to do good. And many times I feel that way about my tithing. Well, could I just take that and give it to who I know needs it, rather than giving it to the central and then having it dispersed out to people? Well, it's not that I have such a big, too many problems with the way the church disperses it. But sometimes I think, I could see for myself who needs it, and I would like to do that. And I think it would be an incredibly sort of a Christian act, an act of spirituality to be able to do that.
But ultimately devastating to the finances of the church.
Probably.
Well, and technically your tithing doesn't go towards helping the poor, it goes towards supporting the church. It's your fast offering that you're supposed to go to. And
I give that out.
Fast offerings. So your fast offerings, you could say, you're not questioned on that ever. I don't think there's anything wrong with going and saying, instead of giving it to the deacons who come to my door on Sunday, I'm going to give it to the lady down the street who I know needs help with groceries.
That might be one way to do it. But I give a lot more in tithing than I do in
Well, Coral ended up excommunicated, so you're on a slippy slope.
Yeah. Any other questions? Let's have one more round of applause. Thank